the Age of Vision radio show with your host, Lonnie Clark. We stand together and accept that we now live in a world transformed by Fukushima. From 8 a.m. to 9 a.m. Pacific Standard Time, here on UCY.TV radio, we relentlessly engage every ear that listens. We expose and confront the complete lack of accountability for the nuclear industry. Consider social engineering programs who view our bodies, minds, and souls as assets on a balance sheet. We discuss vital current issues, interview activists, and engage our audience in an effort to allow all voices to be heard. The Age of Vision radio show creates a venue that all will choose. We encourage our listeners to reclaim their power and their courage to take action and save our planet from the ravages of greed and indifference. Our actions matter. Every voice matters. We remind our listeners that happiness is resistance. Love is greater than fear.
Good morning, UCY.TV radio listeners. This is Lonnie Clark with the Age of Vision radio show. It's 8 o'clock in the morning here on the West Coast. It is 3:13. I can't believe we're already almost halfway through March. Thank you for joining us and welcome. We really appreciate you tuning in. And please remember to let your family members and your friends know that you can reach us only online. You can either watch our podcasts on UCY TV after the show is over or listen live here. Obviously, you found us at www.ucy.tv/AOF. Thanks for joining us. Today we have with us a returning friend of our show and a friend of mine. She's a director at No Nukes Northwest, Heidi Lambert. Welcome to the show, Heidi.
Hi, Lonnie. Thanks for having me.
Well, I really appreciate it. I had you on because we met up at Cape Perpetua at Amanda's statue for the 311, I don't know what we call it, commemoration, silence protest, or I don't know, what do we call that? I don't want to call it an anniversary, but 7 years nonstop of the worst nuclear disaster ongoing on the planet, and the world just seems to act like it's normal.
Yeah, we called it a remembrance, at least my family and I, so we were going to go to the Amanda Trail to in remembrance of 311. And it was really an interesting experience for us because we got to start at the top of the hill and walk down to meet you at the trail, or meet you on the trail, to go and stand in the, to be at the sculpture of Amanda. But the story of Amanda, you know, was that she was blind and barefoot. So to walk in her path and think about what it would be, you know, 200 years ago, you know, with no shoes and no sight, it was just really a very humbling experience.
And the reason that we know about her is one of the soldiers who had was in charge of her had kept a very accurate journal and pretty candidly talked about the Native Americans in, I mean, what would be today considered grotesque fashion. But in his own mind, he was writing compassionately because his orders were to shoot the women and children. So they thought they were being compassionate, allowing them to walk back to the reservation. So
yeah, when they were walking to it, they were definitely being relocated because they were from Coos Bay. And they were coming north from Coos Bay, which I want to say is probably about 60 miles. Long walk on the beach and mountains along the beach. And I believe that the final encampment was in Siletz, which was probably another 60 miles. So she was about halfway. And Perpetua is one of the highest points on the Oregon coast. And so it is considered a coastal mountain range. I don't know the exact elevation, but it was a very narrow trail. And even when I was walking it with my sight, I could see that if you made one wrong step, you would fall to your death. I mean, it's a very steep decline, you know, and it was sometimes when I was in sure footing, I'd close my eyes to just try to get a feel of what it felt like for her to smell and to the sounds. And the ocean hits that rock so hard down below. And it sounds like you're right next to the ocean, but really you're, you know, at least 1,000 feet or more above it. And so, yeah, very powerful experience. And, you know, my husband asked when we were going there, like, why are we going to see Amanda for Fukushima? He's like, Amanda is about remembering the plight of the natives here. What does that have to do with Fukushima? And so I explained to him that I felt that the reason why we were going to Amanda was because Amanda was forced from her home and to leave her daughter. And she had to walk this path unknown, blind and barefoot. And she struggled through that struggle and persevered, and she made it. And so to me, that's hope for us, because we, because of Fukushima, we're contaminating the earth to a whole new level. I mean, we have contaminated the earth to a whole new level in the last 60 years. But Fukushima is proving how uncontrollable and uncontainable that contamination is, and we don't know. Nobody knows how we're going to fix it. So we are all blind and barefoot when it comes to the nuclear hazards of our current Earth. And
yeah,
it's going to take some creative compassion to get through this. So I thought it was very effective and a great way to spend the day. And we were lucky that it was so beautiful, too.
What was interesting on that journey was that I drove up with Jerome Hebert and Kevin Finnegan in my car, and you drove down from the you were driving south, right? And we were driving north.
Yeah.
And so we met, but you guys started at the top of the trail. We looked on the Google Maps and just looked for Amanda's statue parked at the bottom of, like, a big, long country driveway, basically, until you got to where you walked into the path. It was about maybe a quarter of a mile, half a mile in from where we parked into the statue. Wouldn't you say that was maybe half a mile? So we were there quite early, right? And people were coming by, and we three were making videos and exploring and talking about how angry we were about Fukushima, about the... Every expert is silent. I mean, honestly, we didn't see Kevin Camps. We didn't see Helen Caldicott. We didn't see Arnie Gunderson. There was no big effort by any major organization. We didn't see Hanford Challenge, Tom Carpenter. We didn't see anybody talking about, hey, this is 311 and we cannot forget. I mean, it's enough for us activists to be out here, but where are the scientists? Where are the people that know how completely critical this is? And that's what we were kind of talking about that. So this was interesting. We were down there talking, and then we were talking about the people in Fukushima being forced to move back into a contaminated zone and being told that it's considered low-level radiation. That hurts my feelings, too, because they're being forced to say it's low-level. They're living in high levels of radioactive contamination. So we were there, and every person that walked by the statue, that came to look at the statue, I was like, are you here for the Fukushima event? Because I had put up a video, and I didn't know who would see it and who didn't see it.
Sure.
So every person, there was two groups, maybe three. There was a third group, but I don't think I asked that group. But there were two groups. Oh, I think I just lost Heidi. There were two groups that, let me see if I can find her. And I asked them, are you here for the Fukushima event? And they all looked at me and gave me kind of this odd look, right? And then, let me see if I can get her back on the phone. Hang on, let's see. I'm calling Heidi back. The call failed, so maybe the signal is down for a minute. Let me finish with this story. So I had asked everybody to as they were coming, are you here for the Fukushima event? And as soon as they're like, oh, yeah, the tsunami. We're like, we're not talking about the tsunami. We're talking about those three nuclear power plants that are in complete meltdown that are still a disaster. Ironically, those people would just leave. As soon as we said the R word, they would like, you know, obviously we talked to them after they had gone to see the statue, so they were on their way out. But they weren't hanging around as soon as we said the R word. They kind of skedaddled. Let me text Heidi this just to remind her that we have the phone number she can call in, because I cannot get through. So hold on, folks. We were sitting there for quite a while and wondering if Heidi and her kids were coming down. She texted me and said they were hiking down from the top of the trail. And there was a young girl, maybe 14, 15, that came down with a dog. And she sat there. And I didn't talk to her because she was a young woman. And I didn't want to talk to her. I mean, I actually don't talk, you know. I didn't ask her. I didn't think that she would be coming for this. So then as we're waiting, we're getting kind of antsy. And I said, look, I know she's on the trail because she texted us that she was coming halfway down the trail. I said, so let's go up there and meet her. So we decided to gather our stuff. But I had brought a Fukushima sign with this. And it was a sign that I made. And it says, Fukushima is here. Find your courage. Find solutions. I said, well, let's just leave it here because no one's going to take our sign. I didn't want to hike up the mountain with this sign. And I said, Heidi will see us. She'll know us here. And that little girl pipes up. She's like, oh, Heidi, she'll be here soon. I said, you know, Heidi? She goes, yeah, I'm her daughter. So the one person I didn't ask, are you here for the Fukushima thing, was there for the Fukushima thing. So let me see if I can give Miss Heidi a phone call back and see if I can get her back on the phone again. I bet her phone died. Let's see. Let me see if I can call her home phone number. Hang on, you guys. Let me get out my little cell phone. I'm going to do the quick call on her house phone. Because I'll bet you 2-1 that before we got on the air, she didn't even think about it. And so, let me find Miss Heidi. Heidi Lambert. Do, 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 do. This is where we need a tech to come in and play music, right? So let me see if I can give her a call on her home phone. Okay, here we go. Sorry for this, folks. But I want to see if we can get Heidi back on the phone because she has some really good ideas. She has empirical knowledge about what it's like to be living nonstop in a contaminated zone. I think all of us have been, but we're just now realizing it. Let's see if this will work. Actually, that is not working. There is. Oh, here she is. We're going to add her to the group call. Hello, Heidi.
Lonnie?
Yay, here you are. You called in. Thank you. I was just trying to call your house line.
It was really weird. Your phone, the number that I was calling just wouldn't connect. It was like wouldn't even ring. It was just like calling. Very strange. Very strange days.
Yeah, well, you know, we're talking about the R word again. It's that nuclear taboo. On my YouTube channel, I've actually put the videos up under the general tab, but I also have a playlist called Nuclear Taboo. So that's where I put up. We're not supposed to talk about this stuff, so I put stuff like this up under the Nuclear Taboo. I mean, it was shocking, though, out on the coast. It was a really beautiful event. And then I think we parted ways. We went down to where you said go to a Neptune Beach North. We went right down there and we were right at low tide and nothing. There was like the last time Kevin Finnegan and I were out down at down on the coast, just a few miles, maybe 20 miles south of there. There was a ton of like black clams, I guess, stuck to the rock. But there were signs,
maybe.
Mussels, yes. And the signs out there said don't eat the you were not allowed to do not eat, and it had a toxic sign up there. So they were telling people, don't pick them off, you know, just leave them here because they're toxic. But there was no starfish, but there was, we saw one or two starfish, and but they were kind of big and fat ones. And we saw a bunch of sea anemones, is that what you call them, the little round circle things? They're either orange or green. So we saw a bunch of those, not a lot, but that's the only life that we saw. One starfish, and but this time, I mean, we saw baby sea anemones. Anemones, we saw, we didn't see hardly any. And Kevin Finnegan found one starfish, a tiny one, way at the top of a rock. But there was no, and we dug around looking for sea crabs, you know?
Right.
You know, the little, the little sand crabs you can usually dig in the sand. But then again, the beach had no birds. So if there was sand crabs and fish there, it would have had birds.
Yeah, no, in the last 7 years, I've noticed a huge reduction of beach life. Even barnacles. I remember when anything that was under the ocean level for, you know, like high tide, had tons and tons of barnacles on those rocks. And sometimes I'd even find barnacles that were huge, Lonnie. You could tell they were like, you know, decade old. They're just these giant burly barnacles. And now, when I'm at the rocks, I don't notice any barnacles. They're very little, tiny, you know, not very healthy barnacles. And same with the kelp. You don't notice the kelp like you used to, you know, growing on the rocks or being washed up. But I did watch some of your guys' videos of while you guys were at the beach, and I was, it was saddened by that reality that it is very stark compared to what it used to be.
Yeah, and it's not just this area. It's up and down the coast. People in California and San Francisco posted the same thing. People in San Diego, the same thing. It's something, and this is the shock about it. It's shockingly grave, and yet it is being 100% ignored.
Well, all in all, I think that it happened. It's happening actually kind of slowly. And my experience with talking with the fishermen from around here is that it customarily ebbs and flows. So, you know, for 5 years, you'll have a lot of something, and then for 5 years, you don't. And so I feel like a lot of people see the decline, but they expect it to come back. And that's where I think people maybe are mistaken. And I think that, you know, the word here, you don't hear the word Fukushima, and you don't hear the word radiation, but you do hear the word calcification. And there's a lot of conversation about the calcification of the ocean and the warming of the ocean. And there are several scientists. There's actually the Oregon State University has an extension here called the Hatfield. And the Hatfield has, you know, a lot of marine biologists there who are studying, like, the wasting starfish disease and trying to come to the bottom of the calcification of the ocean. And a lot of times, you know, they point at a lot of things. Like they talk a lot about plastics. They talk a lot about industrial chemical use. And that's kind of where nuclear waste in Fukushima kind of gets put into this industrial chemical uses.
That's right. It is. And frankly, you know why? Because the harm of the chemicals lasts as long. I mean, you know, some of them last the same 20,000 years, and they're just as toxic. You know what I mean? That's why, when you look at it, I think. I mean,
well, and sometimes I feel like they're derived from nuclear waste.
Yeah, and they go hand in hand. Exactly. They're used to make nuclear. They're a byproduct of nuclear. They're necessary to make nuclear. I mean, and maybe that's one of the reasons why it's as toxic. Who knows? I mean, we don't even understand this science yet. That's what's becoming, that's what Fukushima really did. It brought it home that they really are way in over their head. Way in over their head.
Yeah. Yeah. And Fukushima, when we say they, it's not the Japanese people. It's the global scientists.
Right.
This is, you know, when Three Mile Island meltdown happened on the East Coast, that they called in all scientists. And no one knew how to fix that problem. No one knew. And then Chernobyl happened. They called in all the scientists to Chernobyl, and the same deal. I mean, there's still scientists who go to Chernobyl to their there's still an evacuation zone at Chernobyl that people can't go back to. And then there's Fukushima, and then you were talking about how they were letting people go back because they're saying that the levels are low enough or safe enough for them to go home. And I have to tell you, that hits a chord with me because that makes me feel about Hanford.
Yeah,
and
yes, it is.
There was a time, right, I believe it was in 2012 or 2013, that we did a demonstration at Hanford, and we had several Japanese students there talking about being evacuated from Fukushima, and they kept asking, why is this not evacuated? Why are people allowed to get so close to this, you know? And all I could say was, well, we've never had a quote-unquote accident. The whole place is an accident. But none of it's considered an accident. It's
right.
all considered an experiment. And so we've always been told it was safe. Even, you know, no matter what the levels were, we're always told that it's safe.
Exactly.
And
that's exactly right.
And that's where I have to laugh a little bit with poor Tom Carpenter with the Hanford Challenge up in Washington right now. Because he just passed a workers' bill, and it's supposed to protect the workers of Hanford, and it's the first of its kind. But I did read through the bill, and it did say that they had to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the cancer or the disease that the person got, they got it from Hanford and not from their personal lifestyle.
Exactly.
And that was something that that had happened with my own dad, because my dad worked at Hanford as a weapons designer and a nuclear engineer in the 70s. And then in the 80s, he started getting cancer and all kinds of different health problems. And they blamed it that he was a farmer. And they said, well, it's because you've been a farmer your whole life and you've been around pesticides and Agent Orange and DDT. And this was at your own responsibility. This is not the responsibility of Hanford.
Wow.
So I hope that gets better, but I have a lot of doubt of the accountability. So
that's an interesting thing for an attorney to agree to, though, that he'd be willing to pass some legislation or have, you know, to even write that up and to support that and call that a victory.
Well,
I wonder what his logic would be.
Well, he believed that it is more protection than what there was. There hasn't been any protection. You know, Lonnie, it's been even.
Well, allowing a clause like that in the legislation is like having no protection, right? That's giving the perpetrators an out completely.
Well,
and this is really just about from what
I view can prove. He just thinks it's provable. He just feels that it's provable. And I feel like it's just one more step.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? He definitely believes in it more than I do.
Well, yeah, and you can prove it, but how long will it take the people to get that proof shown? I mean, 20 years? We know how the nuclear industry works. They fight you in court and you'll tell you drop off from the disease.
Right. Well, that's been the history. That's been
so
how
why
it's been
would a, I mean, to
so.
Me, see, this is... I know this is a thing. I have reached out to Tom Carpenter's office. I'm not bashing Tom Carpenter. I think his work is good. And I have wanted to ask him about things like this because honestly, agreeing to this, in my view, you know, I get what he's saying because some medical bills, because the bill is really about getting these people's medical bills paid. More than anything, that's what they need to have is their medical bills paid. So I think the idea is that some of these diseases, especially the ones that they're going to have, they're very obviously connected to working in the nuclear. They get these weird kind of cancers. They don't just get, you know, oh, I got breast cancer. They get like weird cancers of like your appendix or some freaky kind of melanoma that's eating your brain out from the inside out. Some weird thing. You know what I mean?
Right.
So maybe that's what his thinking was, is because if you really do get harmed at Hanford, the likelihood of you having a cancer that is clearly identifiable is probably pretty high. And maybe that's worth it.
Well, and I'm always, because I was a civilian that lived around Hanford, I just believe there should be more cancer screening for free and, you know, available to everyone who lives there.
Well, let's be clear. We should have that for everybody on this country. What our country needs to have is health care for all. And, you know, if that means we have to cut back some of the spying capacities of this government, go right ahead, because as far as I'm concerned, their spying capacity sucks. They can't, one hand can't talk to the other. For real.
Yeah.
I mean, all these questions, you know, like, you know, this thing about the gun control. What do you think that's about? Same thing.
Right. The fathers of nukes want everyone to have guns, for sure. It's definitely a pro-weapon kind of culture and fear.
Well, it's about
culture.
Making death acceptable. Let's get clear. It's about accepting death in favor of, quote, advancement. And this is where...
Well, I'm really proud. I'm really am proud of this movement of the teens towards, against guns and towards their own rights. I have to say that I'm really excited when I'm seeing what the teens are going to do. Well, I shouldn't say teens. I should just say schools.
The young adults. They're really just young adults. These are young adults and teachers saying, no, we are not going to let you militarize our police. We want reasonable gun legislation so people who shouldn't have guns can be prevented from having them instead of writing out legislation, you know?
Yeah, and well, just these and also, I mean, I work with kids, and I see kids who feel like they're not heard. They feel like they don't matter. They feel like, you know, no one cares. And that culture of kid is the one that goes and gets the gun to begin with. Well, there's something fundamentally wrong with just our communities. And we're starting to notice it becoming more of a problem with devices and computers because more and more people have their relationships, you know, online and aren't really meeting people, talking to people, hugging each other, asking them how they're doing.
Well, you know what? That changes with us. We can make that change. My daughter does not allow her children to have devices. She does not permit them. You know, we can choose. Like, we can choose to put this, you know, to be honest, Kevin Finnegan and Jerome are out here in Oregon with me personally. So I get this. Like, you know, one of the things Tom Ackerman and I have talked about, he lives in Canada, in Ontario. We have known each other 5 years now. We've never met and held each other and been in each other's presence. We both miss that. There would be a kind of bonding. Tom's been wanting it for a long time, but I am not going into Canada. He can come to the United States, maybe. Well, maybe we should get something together and make like a, you know, a national, an international anti-nuke activist convention. That's an idea, huh?
That'd be great. But just to be clear, Lonnie, I'm not against devices. I'm not against devices, nor am I against computers. And I think that as far as like nuke awareness goes, they've been crucial.
Yes.
You know, and
the thing is, it's not actually, just like with the guns, it's not the devices, it's the regulations of the guns. Little kids should not have devices. They should be using imagination and playing. And as you get older, it's a tool for adults, and it's, you know, a form of entertainment, yes, and it can be modified as you get older. Like, you know, as kids become teenagers, okay, you can introduce them, but I think there's a lot of evidence that shows the electromagnetics that come off of devices harm children, and they're already getting radiated from Fukushima and from everything else. So, I mean, this is what I mean about us paying attention to our new environment. Welcome to the age of fission. This is what we're talking about, because there is no turning back. You've made that abundantly clear with your conversations about we got flipped out over Fukushima, yet it's been going on since the 40s.
Yeah, we've been doing it to our own people. We've been doing it on our own land, our own farmland, our own people, and also knowingly releasing radiation. I mean, just not even the bomb testing, but just knowingly experimenting on people. Example is the Green Run, you know, and you know that there is more than just the Green Run.
Right. That's the one we know about. Right. Well, they know they're doing this is actually, I had that thought just late last night while I was working. Like, this is the first generation, I think, of I don't know if the world government or at least we're actually beginning to realize, like, they really are experimenting on the entire population of the earth with, they have made a decision that the technology to get nuclear power and to use those isotopes for their own needs and gains and personal whims is worth messing up human DNA, toxing out the environment. They have gone in full bore. This is the first time where we realize we've been experimented on, all of us.
Yeah, I think the time that I realized the strongest was, there's a really great video online about all of the nuclear bombs that they've dropped in the history of nuclear science. And if you pay attention, you know, it's one of those really dramatic ones, because every bomb it drops, and then it makes a noise, and there's a counter. And then, you know, first it's just the U.S., and then it's Russia, and you see all these China, India, all these different countries getting it. But nobody's bombing in their own country except for the U.S. Everyone's bombing in someone else's country.
Except for
the U.S. And it's usually, well, you know, like France bombed all of North Africa.
Right.
You know, Russia bombed East Europe. It's usually the people they were the most prejudiced against were the people that they tested their nukes on. And that goes back to where the indigenous people are probably the most poisoned of anyone.
That's true.
Anywhere, any indigenous people, anywhere. And some of that has to go back with just their indigenous diets. You know, when I lived in Eastern Washington, it's a huge indigenous population there, and they have been hunting and fishing for, you know, countless years. And so, of course, they were the first affected, because the wildlife is affected. You know, again, it goes back to, for, you know, 50 years, we were convinced that this science was containable and everything was contained. And they kept saying, everything's safe. And everyone wants to believe that. No one wants to believe that their food is contaminated, or their air, or their water. And especially, you know, when, you know, to go back to the topic of children, you know, parents don't want their kids to know.
That's right.
Parents don't want to tell their kids that the world is toxic and that people are harming them, because they feel like they're taking their children's childhood away, or, you know, scaring them or teaching them scary things. You know, one of my children was born in Tri-Cities, and her whole growing up was hearing her father and I talking about contaminations. We were farmers. We were organic farmers, you know, 10, 15 miles from Hanford, and our water was coming from the river. And and we're both have science backgrounds, and we both were just like, wow, how this, you know, transforms into each other, how the world is so interconnected. And when you hear the Native Indigenous people saying how we're all interconnected, to me, they're talking about atoms. They knew that there was this atomic, invisible connection between everything on Earth. And it's always in motion. It's always exchanging. You know, they didn't call it that. They had more spiritual names for it. But
it's what Deepak Chopra talks about. It's about quantum physics. We're all interconnected. Our energies are connected. This is why you can feel someone half across the country, and they'll give you a call. You know what I mean?
Right.
You can actually.
Yeah.
Our energy, it doesn't. This is why Louisa, I put up a video last night of Louisa on my YouTube channel. It's called Northwest Watershed Expert on 7 Years of Silence on Fukushima. At the end of our video of talking, Louisa said, yeah, but you know what? We get to love. We have all this radiation here. We have to love it because it is our new reality. We love it so we can transform it, because as humans, we have this energy to really appreciate everything. We're in symbiosis with it. We can allow solutions to happen. It can you know, like if we allow that, maybe we can transform it. Yeah, and we're all going to die. That's the reality. Yes, we're going to die, but it is still a magnificent, beautiful earth that we get to enjoy. And if we live at that higher vibration, it allows the answers to perpetuate itself. Que perpetua.
So, right, that's beautiful. I don't know if we have to love it, but I definitely think it helps to accept it. And by accepting it is by acknowledging that the misuse and the corruption exist. And I feel that that is what we need to face head on.
Yes, yes.
And the greed that are abusing this science and leading its waste and, you know, so irresponsible with it. And that's where it comes to be, where at some point our Earth might not be the same, you know, and that's
well, the Earth is not the same. We can actually see that the Earth is not the same. We saw tide pools in the coast of Oregon where there ought to be a lot of life. There was barely nothing. It was a beautiful day. Yeah. There were no birds, no seals, no starfish, no mussels, no sea anemones, no sand crabs. Literally nothing.
It's very similar to standing on the edge of the Columbia River. Because, again, there should be lots and lots and lots of different kinds of fishes, lots of different species of bugs, lots of birds living off those fish. And when you go to the Columbia River down from Hanford, there isn't those things. Mm-hmm. And you can go to, you know, Santa Fe has the same story. I mean, like, every reactor has a story of it. I mean, this is straight out of the Lorax. This is why Dr. Seuss wrote the Lorax, is because he saw in the 60s, people need to speak for the trees and for the animals, and they have to see bigger than themselves. Otherwise, it's going to look like freaking page out of a Dr. Seuss book of it being black, no trees, no animals, smoke, you know. That's my fear, is that if people don't start paying attention and doing things, the corruption will continue, and it will keep on, and it just will keep getting worse. Because, like you said, this contamination doesn't go away. It lasts for thousands of years. And the thing that's so scary about it, Lonnie, is it's invisible. It's right. Not something people can smell or see right. Like coal. It's invisible.
Or taste
it. So you don't even know.
That's why it's in your food. You don't know it's in your food.
Yeah, and I felt horrible because Jerome, you know, when he was walking on the trail, he carried his Geiger counter. And he was so diligent about his Geiger counter. And I remember having that feeling of security with that Geiger counter myself. But then at some point you realize that when radiation is a gamma ray, when it gets absorbed into a biological form, say a tree, a person, a dog, it changes. So I was trying to tell him, you can't take your Geiger counter and, like, Geiger people. It will tell you if you have radiation, like, on your surface, like, in your clothes or, on, you know, in your pocket. But if you eat it in the form of, like, kelp or...
Right, like, you can't put it over food, and the Geiger counter won't tell you if it's got that because it's embedded in the food. It only goes when it goes... When you ingest it is when the harm really happens.
It changes. You got to remember that we're talking atomic. So those atoms break, you know what I mean? It's not a solid form. It's a very fluid form. And those atoms, some are split and some aren't split, but they make, like, say, a water molecule. And then that broken atom will go find another atom. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, once we split those atoms, we can't put them back together, but they're still on our Earth.
Right.
In their half forms, in their crippled forms, or whatever you want to, however you want to describe it, you know, right. And they're still trying to exist in our world. And that's where I try to explain to people about the ocean, because so many people here will say, oh, the ocean is so big, it can handle it. It will heal itself.
That's right.
It's heal, you know, give it time. It will heal itself. Yeah. And it's like, no, you know, when I, 10 years ago, I can't even tell you how many people made their living off of tuna fishing here in Newport, Oregon. Mm. There were huge tuna boats that would go, you know, 200, 300 miles out off the ocean, and they would catch the tuna, the tuna does like a circular
migration through the Pacific. And it kind of goes the ring of fire where it goes, you know, down Japan, over to Hawaii, over to California, up to, you know, wherever this current goes in the circular motion. And so when it comes off the West Coast, all of these folks would go out and catch all this tuna and huge fish, Lonnie, huge fish. And I mean, it's just amazing, these beautiful fish, these bluefin tunas. And Fukushima happened, and the fishermen all laughed about how these hippies say it's going to be a problem. The next year, the tuna population was a fourth of what it was. Now we're 7 years later. People, first off, don't even, if you talk to people about eating tuna, that's the first thing they'll tell you they don't eat because of Fukushima.
And people in Newport tell you they don't eat tuna?
Yeah, a lot of people don't eat tuna. A lot of people, that's like the one thing I feel like was reported well about. And again, tuna, you know, they would, I believe they did a huge study out of California with them where they pulled up so many and they were just full of cysts and tumors. And but that was the beginning. Now they're just not there. Now there is no
tuna. Well, they
tuna
stopped
population.
Testing
it's
the
very
tuna.
Small.
I know they stopped testing the tuna because 100% of them tested positive. For quite a while.
Yeah, and it's so that did get out. You know, people understood that. But then I tried to explain to them, well, you know, that's still effective. I mean, one of the examples I have is that when Fukushima happened, one of the things that happened here on the coastline was we saw a ton of tsunami debris. And when I say tsunami debris, I mean like pieces of buildings, entire boats.
You didn't touch any of that, did you?
Big. A lot of it is exhibited here in town.
What?
A lot of it. Well, there's a weird. The other thing about the Fukushima thing is you have to remember that Fukushima was a gigantic earthquake that caused a dynamic tsunami. And that is something that we live in here
tsunami,
on the
though.
Coast.
Well,
have
then you taken
it turned
a good Geiger counter and have they tested it? Have they done any really good Geiger counter readings on that thing?
Yeah, but I don't think that it sat. That's the other thing too, Lonnie. Is it wasn't. It didn't stick around. It didn't. You know, it would be different if you were to test like metal or concrete coming away from Fukushima that's been there. This is pieces of, you know, property that got freed in the tsunami. But my point is that if those gigantic objects can show up here on the beach, why wouldn't this invisible atomic radiation be here? And that's when we started seeing in like 2015, people like Malcolm Chaddock, who came with a Geiger counter, and he started, him and Richard Wood, actually, out of Portland, they started coming and Geigering the kelp. They started Geigering the, you know, when you catch tuna on your own boat, there's a table at the dock that you can clean the tuna out in. Richard would stick his Geiger counter on a fishing pole and drop it into the gut tank.
Uh-huh.
And he would get huge high readings of like 130 plus.
Did they
gut.
Document that and take pictures of it?
Yeah, they sure did. And, you know, now Richard, he takes a Geiger counter and rides his bike through Portland and shows different readings of the parks and, you know, but
does he post it on Facebook, or does he have a page, or what?
So, yeah, I see it on Facebook. I don't know if he does it on Radcast or not. He might give some of his information to Radcast.
Okay.
But Richard Wood, he's an amazing scientist.
I've talked to him. I've asked him to come on. He's been very shy to come on. He wants to be absolutely certain of his facts, just like a scientist.
Yeah, he is very factual.
Scientific. I appreciate it.
He's a great guy. Yeah, great guy. So again, there are studies and tests that citizens are doing to bring the awareness of it. And in Lincoln County also, we've had our own struggle here because we have a really active community rights group. And the community rights group here, one of the biggest problems we were having here, because we don't have reactors here, Oregon actually outlawed commercial reactors years ago. I want to say in the 80s. Peaceworks. I'm trying to think of the gentleman, Peter and Charles Johnson, worked with Peaceworks to outlaw commercial
reactors. You mean Chuck Johnson that we have on the show?
Yeah.
Do you mean Peter Shabarek?
Yeah.
I know Peter
Shabarek. They worked together, I believe it was in the 80s. It could have been, I'm pretty sure it was in the 80s, where they outlawed, the people voted to outlaw reactors.
So I asked Peter to be on the show. You know what his response was? Oh, no, I've done that. You'll find young people to be on. I'm like, come on. Really, seriously. Yeah. I would love to have them on because they have some perspective on how they got it done, because it was work. That's the thing. This is work. It's not easy. It's work.
Well, and it doesn't pay.
That's right.
It's work that pays in your well-being and how you, sleep at night.
That's
but it doesn't pay. I mean, if you want to be a nuclear scientist, you're going to make a lot more money than if you're going to be against it, you know. But this goes back to community rights is where I'm at.
Because, yes.
I actually think you know more about it than I do, Lonnie, because I do believe it comes out of Eugene. And I know that it's a movement they're trying to get to be more national.
Well,
and I know. Oh, can I just share real quick why we're using it in Lincoln County? And then you can tell me what you know about it.
Please do.
Okay, so in Lincoln County, we have logging is the major industry. And after they log huge acreage, they aerial spray that acreage with pesticides, much like DDT. So we've seen a huge incline of cancers, and we've seen a huge decline in, like, say, frogs, you know, birds, you know, lots of nature. And so the community's rights group came here from Eugene and taught citizens here, and then they started creating laws that we voted on as a community that says we don't want aerial spray. And so my understanding of community rights is that we have a right to healthy living environment, but we have to work together against the corporation saying that they can't override our rights.
We had Kai Hushka on from the Environmental Legal Community Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDEF, and because I took the democracy school here in Eugene last summer, and he explained that because of the way our Constitution is written, corporations have equality with the state and the feds, and they generally, because they have a right to profit. So unless we get our rights to ourselves, you know, we get it established at a, we pass it at a local level, a city level, county level, if you don't have a city, and then you get the state to ratify their constitution and accept it, you know, then you have equality with corporations. That's what he was talking about. And this did happen in a community here in Oregon. And I believe it was in your neck of the woods in Lincoln County, where now they can no longer spray over, town.
Yeah, and so that is what they're saying, is that we did do it, and so because we did it, everyone in Oregon can do it.
That's
and then
right.
They're saying, we don't want to stop at Oregon. We want to do it in Washington and California. Like, let's make this a national
thing. That's right.
Where, as a community, we have a right to healthy living. So I guess we need to take it to our commissioners and to our county county councils first this grassroots effort has been going on for, you know, probably since the 70s here.
It has. It's been a long time. And the thing is, people are getting serious. The cool thing about the Oregon Constitution that Kai said made it easier was that in our Constitution in Oregon, it says we have a right to a clean, a healthy lifestyle here in Oregon.
Right.
So that little book is one step above, say, Pennsylvania, where you don't have that right. So that's where corporations fight this effort in court. They're like, this is unfair and unjust to us. So it's this legal wrangle that goes on here. But it does matter, because it's the right up to whether we actually have rights over the corporate pollution.
Well, and here, you know, when the community rights groups, the community right group, I should call it, and you can Google them. They have their own website. It's Lincoln County Community Rights. When they started really getting serious in this fight, when we got it on the ballot this last year, you wouldn't believe the amount of money the logging companies like Georgia Pacific, Weyerhaeuser, BLM. I mean, these companies like BLM, the Bureau of Land Management, has existed before even the U.S. Constitution. Like that came over with Europe. You know what I mean? If you really think about it, our resources here have always been resources for somebody. And so they did not like this. They don't, because this is going to cost money for them to pay people to have backpacks or however. Either they're not going to log certain areas or they're going to have to log them differently. And so, of course, they don't like being told that. And I couldn't believe the amount of propaganda that was put out and mailed to the citizens of our county against what
really?
They've been talking about. Yeah, and it reminded me, Lonnie, so much of living around Hanford.
You know what you need to do when you start getting those things is you need to actually make a quick YouTube video and videotape it. Put all the flyers together and say this is what they're making so people can see. Because this, I think one of the things why people don't engage is they don't understand how it happens, but it seems like how do communities get brainwashed? And this is how, by this propaganda that they're mailing out. And I think if we call it out, that's why documenting the coast was really important at low tide. That was really a shock. I personally was shocked. I did not expect it to be that bad. I had not seen it.
And I think for people like myself who live here and go there on a weekly, it feels like it's happened very... it happens really slow. You know what I mean?
Right. You get accustomed to it.
Really
exactly.
Fast, but you see, you get used to it. Yeah. It's hard. And the same goes when I lived by Hanford. I remember, there's 500 miles around Hanford that they call a nature reserve.
Right.
And which is really kind of funny to me. But when you're out there, like, there is no sagebrush. If there is, it's like very tiny. It's more like a grassland. And I remember thinking to myself, when you get off the Hanford Reservation, and you get past it, you see these huge, beautiful, old sagebrush bushes. And so it's just like those. That's another example of how these areas are so contaminated. They're still green. It's not like they're exactly dead yet, but they are more unhealthy and not as healthy as they've been. And so, you know what I mean? Every year you start to see less and less. And I love to follow Tim Masu, who's a scientist who goes to Fukushima and studies bugs and the birds.
Yes.
Yeah, amazing studies. And, so much of what he's learned is it's not the first generation that's exposed that is affected. It's generations after. Like, the magic number, I believe, is 7 generations.
That's right.
And he started documenting birds that started having, after 7 generations, 1 blue eye and 1 brown eye.
Huh.
And different kinds of feather mutations that are odd. So at first, they're almost beautiful. It's almost like a beautiful act of nature. And you think that it's so beautiful. And then you find out that really it's because it's mutated because of the DNA. You know, and then this goes back to children. I just have to go back to kids because... I have 2 kids, and they're very, very smart, and they're very interested in DNA and genetic science. I mean, it's something that they're learning in schools, and they're starting to get it. And then because of me being their mom, we have conversations about radiation and on the atomic level and how that influences DNA. But I don't think most people can have that conversation. I really don't. I think a lot of people.
I couldn't. I mean, I give people a basic bare understanding of it, but, I don't even think like that. Like, scientific conversations are a challenge for my brain to even wrap my way around. I mean, anybody's heard me interview Shazam or Larry Woods, who I'm hoping that Jerome did interview Larry Woods. I mean, you have to have a scientific mind to talk scientifically. So when I interview these men, I don't have the right questions because I know I don't know it. That's the weird part. You know what I mean? there's a saying that says you don't know what you don't know until you know you don't know it. Well, I know I don't know it.
Well, I feel like that's the best place to start, Lonnie, you know, because at least you're curious.
But I do get this on an intuitive level. See, I understand. I've read the science. Like, I've read these journals. I read the reports. I can comprehend it, but to digest it and speak about it is a challenge for me, which I think is where most people are. Intelligent people can understand the science. Now, to regurgitate it and explain it and make it not scary to kids, that's another thing. You know what I mean?
Right.
It really, it's a challenge. This is part of the challenge. It's not just facing it, but it's like really still appreciating life. And we have a life to live, period. And our biggest challenge, really, we're just being bombarded on all sides. And, you know, we're realizing that, frankly, I think the biggest shock is that our government really has knowingly experimented on us, knowingly done this. They knew exactly what they were doing. They had already seen the proof in their experiments, which they were denying they saw. And they've continued to experiment and continue to deny. It's like you said, in Fukushima now, they're taking like the Hanford tactic, the Richland tactic. Like, oh, don't worry, it's not going to harm you. You can move 12 miles away from Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plants that are still in a meltdown zone. And we're not quite sure why it's expanding the radiation outside the zone, but you'll be fine.
Yeah. And people want to go home. So they want to believe it.
Yeah.
I've had some fun. I have to admit, I've had some fun with my kids talking about nukes. And I don't know if that's kind of a weird thing to say, but one of my favorite things that we did that we actually, the kids brought up when we were, when we met at Amanda Trail, was when we made a gallon of nuclear waste. And it was really a great activity. And I love that my kids remember it, and they remember it really fondly in a weird way. We took a cider, a 1 gallon cider glass jar, and we went to the store, and I let the kids pick out like 3 different kinds of candies. And we had like Pop Rocks and gummy worms and like just different kinds of sugar candies that were different colors. And I told them we were going to make an experiment with it. And they said, well, can we eat them? And I said, well, when we're done, if you feel like you still want to eat it, you can eat it. You know, I said, but we're not doing this to eat. But they're little, so they want to eat the candy. But we made up yogurt. We made up Jell-O. And we did 2 different colors of Jell-O. And I said, you know, this is what the reaction, this was the nuclear waste when they first made nuclear waste, and they poured it in the tank. And so we put the red Jell-O in. And then I said, you know, but then a year later, they made some different nuclear waste, and this came out green, but they thought it was the same, so they poured it in the same tank. And so we poured the green in with the red, and it kind of swirled around and made different colors. And then I said, but then they started to realize how poisonous this was, and so they had to get rid of all of the lab tools that they used to make the first batch. And so we would stick all of the Pop Rocks in. And then I said, you know, but then they realized that the second lab was also poisonous. So they had to put all the lab equipment from the second lab in there. And so then we stuck in, you know, all of the jelly beans. And then I said, but then they realized when they made the third batch, it wasn't like the first or the second, but they had all this other waste. And so then we put the Pop Rocks in there. And so we started sticking all of this different candy in there. And this is what happened at Hanford. They really did experiment and not know what they did and put it all together in these different tanks. This is a true story. I mean, it wasn't candy. It was waste. But they mixed it. And the thing about it, Lonnie, is it was so damn top secret. Nobody knew who put what in what tank. So that's what I was trying to show to my kids, is that they put this, what they called garbage or waste, in these tanks thinking it was fine. So at one point...
So Heidi, we have 10 seconds left.
Oh, no!
You have to come back. Put your courage feet on, you guys. You've been listening to Heidi Lambert. You must come back. We must get back to this candy story.
Nuclear waste. You can make your own.
Bye.